Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the possibility of a financial meltdown in Cyprus if Monday's deadline to avert a collapse of the island's banking system is not met. James Henry, the Edward R. Murrow Fellow at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Diplomacy, joins us to look into whether a collapse of this treasure island of laundered Russian money could have broader ramifications for the Eurozone and why the lessons of the dangers of unregulated banks appears to have no impact on Wall Street's push for deregulation and overturning Dodd-Frank. Then we'll go to Jordan for a report on President Obama's recent trip and the refugee crisis the kingdom is facing from the civil war next door in Syria. Dawood Khatab, who established the Arab world's first internet radio station, AmanNet, joins us to provide a regional analysis of the likely impact of an increasingly desperate Assad regime in its last throes, provoking a wider conflict, and what domino effect the fall of the Syrian dictatorship will have on the neighborhood. Then finally, we'll speak with Douglas Rushkoff about his new book, Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now, an expert on the intersection of technology and culture, who in 2004 predicted the current recession and coined the phrase viral media. Rushkoff argues that it's not technology that is the problem, but our misunderstanding of time, where the priorities of the moment seem to be everything. Joining us now is James Henry, who's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is the Edward R. Murrow Fellow at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and Inspire Fellow at its Institute for Global Leadership. He was the lead researcher on the Tax Justice Network's recent report, The Price of Offshore Revisited. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good to be here.
And the French finance minister has described Cyprus as a casino economy that is on the brink of bankruptcy. Why then is this so important to the Eurozone? Is this something they can handle, or is this the beginning of its unraveling?
Well, I think on paper it looks like a relatively tiny problem. I mean, they're talking about needing to come up with at most another $8 billion to finance this. They've already offered $10 billion. So compared to the Greek bailout, where we had the European Central Bank providing 240 billion euros last year, this is tiny. But the symbolic thing is important because The EU and Angela Merkel of Germany in particular have kind of put a line in the sand and said, you know, we are not going to bail out oligarchs. And, Cyprus's banks now have at least $26 billion of Russian money, much of which is suspected of coming from the underground economy there. And so she's facing an election in November. She doesn't want to be in a position of looking like they're providing a total bailout. So they're insisting that Cyprus come up with about half the money on its own, and that's been the sticking point.
Well, I guess the history then, I'm not sure of it, but my understanding is, for example, during the collapse of Yugoslavia and the subsequent wars in the Balkans, Milosevic, the Serbian leader, apparently essentially looted the Yugoslav treasury and parked it all in Cyprus for him and his cronies. So when did the Russians decide that this was their Cayman Islands?
Well, the Russians have been in Cyprus for a long time, even before going back to the Crimean War. I mean, their alliance with the Greek Orthodox kind of groups and
co-religious,
a lot of ties to a lot of kind of cultural ties there as well. But at the turn of the Cold War, $300 billion left Russia during the first few years, and a lot of it ended up going to havens like Cyprus. Cyprus only got admitted to the EU back in 2004, the EU was being pressured by Greece. Basically, Greece said that you can't admit any other countries in Eastern Europe unless you admit Cyprus. So even though Cyprus has, it's half the size of Connecticut and has a population of, 860,000 Greek Orthodox, it's really outsized influence on this whole situation. But I think the origins of this particular crisis are the fact that the Cyprus banks were offering huge interest rates on deposits, and they were investing heavily in the Greek banks that were kind of issuing junk bonds back in 2007, 2008. And they really got creamed when the EU insisted on a so-called haircut for the Greek bond owners last year. That was the start of the most recent crisis. So it's really a situation where unregulated banking at the country level, which is a problem that the EU has struggled with. It really doesn't have effective banking regulation country by country, and it's trying to maintain this common currency policy in the absence of effective bank regulation, which is, you know, a fundamental problem with the EU model.
Well, this seems to be a completely distorted economy. If the deposits in the banks are eight times the country's GDP, and if, as you mentioned, these banks were attracting outside capital, a lot of it, you know, black money, dirty money, whatever you want to call it. I know that wasn't necessarily the case in Iceland, but my understanding in Iceland was that they were also attracting foreign deposits by offering high interest rates. And again,
they were doing, yeah, exactly the same thing. But in Cyprus, you have an even worse situation where effectively you have a real active tax haven. I mean, their corporate tax rate is 10%. Tax rate is 10%, and there's a lot of deductions from that. So there's a lot of round-tripping investment going into Europe by way of Cyprus, and Germany is upset about that. You also have 54,000 non-resident companies based in Cyprus and very, very low individual income taxation. And so you also have these all this money pouring through Cyprus and in the form of banking deposits, a lot of complaints about money laundering. So this is, you know, a little bit different from Iceland in that it's kind of wild west banking, wild east banking, I guess we should call it. But these folks have managed to get themselves into the EU and have exploited the common currency to attract, you know, all this investment money, knowing that they might be bought or hoping that they would be bailed out.
Again, I'm speaking with James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist. He's the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company and is an Edward R. Murrow Fellow at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and Inspire Fellow at its Institute for Global Leadership. He was the lead researcher on the Tax Justice Network's recent report, The Price of Offshore Revisited. So if this has been a haven for Russian and Ukrainian money, laundered, if you will. What's Putin complaining about? I mean, I guess Putin would like to tax some of this money. Is that what's going on?
Well, I think Putin is playing a fairly interesting game here because, you know, he loaned Cyprus 2.5 billion euros about a year ago. And I think he's also interested in the fact that Cyprus has just found a lot of gas with the help of a U.S. company. They found reportedly 8 trillion cubic feet in a gas deposit within Cyprus national boundaries. And, you know, Gazprom is reported to have offered to assume some of the Cyprus bailout if, you know, they were given rights to develop those gas reserves. You know, Russia is also facing a situation where it may be having to relocate its naval base in Syria. And so Cyprus, you know, may be looking attractive from that standpoint. So I think Putin is simply standing by and sort of saying, well, I have no incentive to step in now. Let's see what the EU does if they bail these folks out or they come up with a resolution. You know, I'm no worse off. Otherwise, there may be some opportunities. So he has no incentive to move quick here.
I see. But my understanding is, though, that the latest thing on the table with the government of Cyprus that's in these desperate negotiations with Brussels, they want a $10 billion bailout, but they got to raise, what, about eight? They got to raise most of the money to get a bailout, which is a bit odd, it seems. But My understanding is the latest idea is, because, you know, the regular depositors under $100,000 were furious that they were going to be taxed and essentially 6.6% of their money confiscated. Now they apparently are going to put it all on the big depositors like the Russians. So
That's one of the things that, you know, the Cypriot government is in a tough place. They really don't want to be beholden to Russia either. They've already granted citizenship, according to the German intelligence, to about 80 Russian oligarchs, who are people with full EU rights. But no, you're right. The latest proposal that was being presented called for a 25% tax on deposits above 100,000 euros. And, you know, that would hit those Russian depositors pretty hard. You know, I think Cyprus would pretty clearly like to get the EU to support it and not to have to deal with the Russians. But I'm just saying that if that doesn't work out today, and the Brussels meeting is going on as we speak, so we'll know pretty soon. You know, they maybe have to go back to Plan C, I guess.
But wouldn't that mean that as a haven, Cyprus would lose all of that money? I mean, if you're going to have 25% of your money confiscated, that's hardly a deal if you're a tax dodger and a money launderer.
Well, there's a lot of dissension within the haven community in Cyprus about where the future lies. I mean, there's a whole constituency of, you know, several thousand accountants and lawyers that want the Cyprus to move in the same direction that places like Bermuda have gone, which is to have a more sort of orthodox form of haven where you're focusing on, you know, helping offshore corporations or helping major companies do their tax dodging instead of working with outright money launderers. So, you know, there are some that would actually welcome this step. My own view is that it's hard to see Cyprus coming out of this as a haven. With the same kind of resilience they've had, they've already accepted the idea of having capital controls, this levy on depositors. You know, they're reportedly being asked to raise their corporate tax rate from 10% to something more in line with what the Europeans have. So all of this, you know, means that Cyprus will have to, you know, I think change its business model, whatever it does here.
And be more like Bermuda and the Cayman Islands? Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, you know, that would actually be a step up from what they've been doing, which appears to be outright money laundering.
Sure.
You know, it's also, I think, the EU is beginning to recognize that, you know, it was probably a mistake to simply allow in a country like Cyprus that has this kind of basic commitment to being a haven. I mean, the financial sector there is about 20% of its gross national product. And, you know, it's about to be decimated by whatever it does in this situation. So, you know, the amounts involved here are so small that it's hard to see that the EU would let them go belly up. But it may well be that you know, Merkel is just not willing to inject more money into this haven.
Well, she's sure unpopular in Cyprus. They're blaming it all on the Germans.
Yeah, I think that one thing they've clearly achieved, I mean, this has been another EU goat rodeo where the solution has been on the table and being kicked around for close to a year now without action, and they had to come to a crisis to resolve it. You know, they managed to start a bank run 2 weeks ago. They were, you know, sort of originally, I think, too lenient on Cyprus with respect to rules about money laundering and, you know, this banking system, and never really put the rules in place that they may now need to you know, that they certainly need to have EU-wide for bank regulation. So at the end of the day here, I expect there will be a solution worked out with the EU, which will call for tougher bank regulation in Cyprus and you know, a levy on these depositors.
So, James Henry, why is it then that the lessons of the dangers of these Treasure Island offshore havens, excuse me, with their unregulated banks, why does this not have any impact on Wall Street's push for deregulation and their determination to overturn Dodd-Frank?
Well, you know, Dodd-Frank was passed in a kind of a crisis environment, and then the banks have been allowed to go back to, you know, sort of normal behavior, which is for them what we call regulatory mining. And, you know, they have an army of lobbyists. They're spending something like $2,700 per congressman per day on lobbying in Washington. And, you know, it's not that they don't often benefit from government intervention, but they wouldn't be here today
but for government intervention, right?
So it isn't across the board, you know, free market position when it comes to regulation. But you know, I just think they can't resist the general kind of opportunity to make regulations as bank friendly as possible. So you know, and on the other side, there's relative handful of NGOs like Tax Justice Network, Citizens for Tax Justice, that are working these issues in Washington and other capitals around the world. We've grown in influence and importance over the last decade, but you know, it's still nothing like the armies of lawyers and accountants that descend on the Treasury Department or the congressional hearings when you have policy being made in these areas. So, you know, it's an uphill battle to prevent the banks from getting back to their old forms of behavior.
And this kind of lesson from Cyprus has no impact?
I would say that, you know, that this should make us all concerned about the role of dirty money in the international financial system, about the absence of effective bank regulation, about, you know, this is all eminently avoidable. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's kind of the lessons learned when you have the, or unlearned, when you have the banking industry left to its own devices, you know, you end up with, you know, these kinds of fiascos. I also think the EU has basically taken, you know, far too long to figure out how to, you know, to operate a effective banking regulation. And that's partly because their own banks are very powerful and, you know, don't want tougher regulation either. But, you know, I think it's time these kinds of recurrent crises, you know, are having impacts on the world economy, and you know, they're just way out of proportion to the, you know, the value that was created by the banking freedom to begin with. So I think mm-hmm. that, you know, this is just another example of the need for, you know, more sort of considered look at the role of bank regulation as an essential ingredient in solving the economic crisis. So this day, we still don't have. You know, Dodd-Frank is still being implemented in the United States. It's still the lobbyists in Washington are still working hard to undermine it and roll it back. And, you know, so there's, I mean, and of course, no bankers have gone to jail for any of the misbehavior that occurred in the last
right, and of course, years. As you point out, they have the best of both worlds. They have socialized risks and a capitalist upside. So,
yeah, well, I think that's, you know, but I think one lesson for tiny countries that are thinking about becoming havens is it's instructive to look at the Cyprus example, because this kind of problem is now occurred again and again for small countries that bet heavily on this financial sector and the international chicanery that goes along with it. They've ended up over and over again having big disappointments at the end of the day.
Well, James Henry, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with James Henry, who's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is the Edward R. Murrow Fellow at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and Inspire Fellow at its Institute for Global Leadership. He was the lead researcher on the Tax Justice Network's recent report, The Price of Offshore Revisited. We're going to take a brief station break and be back and then go to Aman Jordan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Daoud Qutob, who is a former Ferris Professor of Journalism at Princeton University, where he taught a seminar on new media in the Arab world. Qutob is a Palestinian journalist and media activist who was born in Jerusalem and studied in the United States and lives in Jordan. In 2000, he established the Arab world's first internet radio station, AmanNet, at www.amannet.net. An award-winning journalist and TV producer, Mr. Qutob is active in media freedom efforts in the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daoud Qutob.
Thank you very much.
And President Obama visited Jordan. Of course, he went to the historic Petra ruins after meeting with King Abdullah. So what's the takeaway today, the day after, in Jordan?
Well, Jordan, you know, is a strong ally of the U.S. I think after Israel, it's probably the strongest ally to the U.S. in the region. And Jordan feels very gratified by the visit of Obama. The U.S. has approved further cash grant to the Jordanian Treasury. Jordan is having a kind of a financial crisis of their own. And they feel quite happy with the visit. Of course, the real issue is the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and it seems that Jordan is going to be playing some kind of a role in trying to bring both parties together.
So in terms of the last time we spoke, when you had an article in The Atlantic, are Palestinians ready to share a state with Jordan? Is there any follow-up on that? Because prior to President Obama's visit to Israel, King Abdullah was quoted saying that he's totally frustrated with the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, and that Abbas is more obsessed with the Israelis than he is about taking care of his own people, the Palestinians. It was kind of a pretty damning comment. So what's going on in that regard?
I'm not sure about this comment, but the relations between
I mean, the comment happened, though, didn't it? I mean, it's an accurate quote, isn't it?
I don't remember seeing it. I don't know. Whatever the quote was, I mean, King Abdullah had his own problems with quotes lately with an article by Jeffrey Goldberg, but be that as it may, as far as we know, the relationship has been improved. It has been quite good between King Abdullah and President Abbas, and I think by all means, the king visited Ramallah. Abbas is here in Amman. He comes here very often. So there is no real sign that there is any tension on that level. The question, of course, is that everybody is trying to figure out a way to kickstart the negotiations, and the Israelis have been very stubborn in refusing to freeze the settlement activities, which in many people's eyes shows that they're not serious about peace.
Well, that is a subject in itself. We could spend the next hour talking about that, Daoud Qutob. But let's talk about the King Abdullah's press conference, where he pointed out to the president and to the broader or the wider American audience that the refugee crisis that Jordan faces because of the Syrian war, the civil war in Syria, would be the equivalent of the United States having 30 million refugees suddenly dumped on them, and that number could double to 60 million soon. And that's the situation that Jordan faces, right?
It is. It's quite a big humanitarian problem. People are coming in daily, sometimes hundreds, sometimes even 1,000 people coming in. And the big problem, of course, is housing and water. Jordan is a very water-poor country, and the presence of so many refugees is really depriving this country of the badly needed water and other resources, you know, schooling, hospitals, food, shelter, you know, all these areas are a major concern to the Jordanians. And, you know, there is international support, but it's way short of what is needed.
So the $200 million that President Obama pledged to help the Syrian refugees in Jordan, is that sufficient or not?
I'm not sure. I don't know that the 200 is about for the refugees, but certainly it's a huge boost to Jordan's cash-strapped economy, and would help in laying some of the costs of the Syrian problem. There's no doubt about it. But it's really a continuous problem because it's depriving water, but it's also extracting labor. People are being replaced now with much cheaper Syrian labor, and that's causing also some kind of social problems in the north of Jordan. So there's different levels of problems that the Syrian issue is causing to the country.
And Jordan is a small country, as you mentioned. It's water poor. And it already had to absorb a lot of refugees from Iraq, from the previous Iraq war.
Yes, and even going back further, the Palestinian conflict, this country has been living on absorbing refugees. And to be fair, it's not all bad. I mean, Jordan has actually benefited from so many refugees, not just because of humanitarian support, but people usually bring with them money and projects and their entrepreneurship. So it shouldn't always be seen as a negative, but in the short term, it does cause some problems for a country like Jordan.
So Dawood Qutob again in Amman, Jordan. He's a former Ferris Professor of Journalism at Princeton University, where he taught a seminar on new media in the Arab world. And he's a Palestinian journalist, media activist. He was born in Jerusalem, studied in the United States, and lives in Jordan. In 2000, he established the Arab world's first internet radio station, Amman Net, and he is active in media freedom efforts in the Middle East. Let's turn to the broader issue of the Syrian conflict. And I think there's no question, at least in my mind, Dawood, that last-minute phone call that President Obama arranged between the Turkish Prime Minister and the Israeli Prime Minister on the tarmac has a lot to do with the Syrian situation. In fact, Prime Minister Netanyahu said it did. What do you think is going on there? It seems to me that this may be an indication that there's going to be some kind of joint military action between the Turks and the Israelis.
Well, you know, the big problem in Syria is that the different world countries are not able to create a no-fly zone. And the Syrian Air Force is acting sometimes in very nasty way, shelling rebel locations and sometimes civilian populations. And that's something that nobody's been able to stop. And I think there's more and more talk about the idea of finding a way to stop the use of the heavy weapons by the Syrian government. Apparently, the Syrian anti-air defenses are very sophisticated. And I think so. If NATO is ever going to be involved, Turkey has to be involved, and possibly Israel, although this is a very politically sensitive subject. So a lot of it would have to be taken care of by a country like Turkey. So I think on that level, it's very important. I'm not sure that the Syrian issue is the only one that is causing problems for Israel. The Turkey is the only Muslim country that is part of NATO and has a peace agreement. I mean, have embassies between Turkey and Israel. So the breakup of relations was detrimental to the Israeli attempt to kind of open up to the rest of the world, especially Europe, and Turkey is a key country in that level. So there's been a number of reasons. The one man who is against all this is Avigdor Lieberman, the former foreign minister, who's now facing his own trial for corruption, and he's therefore not in any position to be able to stop an attempt to have an apology. So I think, in a way, different pieces of the puzzle happened to have happened at the same time. President Obama's effort is certainly a key factor that I think encouraged Netanyahu to take that step of apologizing.
Well, there's no way that the Israeli troops could occupy or even put their foot on Syrian soil. I don't think that would, although the assumption is that somebody's going to go in there probably soon to secure the chemical arsenals. And obviously it would make more sense for Turkish Islamic soldiers to be involved. But the whole region, as you well know, Daoud Kitab, is a tinderbox. And my understanding is that Secretary of State John Kerry, of course, went to Iraq and met with the Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki and tried to convince him to stop the Iranian overflights. Iran is supplying the Assad regime around the clock now. They're doubling down. The West seems to be vacillating about who to support. And, you know, as you know, there was one of the leaders of the Syrian opposition just quit in frustration because the West is not supplying arms like Iran is supplying arms to Assad. My understanding is that if and when the Assads fall, that is likely to have a ripple effect into Iraq. And Iraq is the most unstable domino, if you will, because already the Sunni are very restive and so are the Kurds. So you're right next door there. What do you think is going on here? I mean, is that possible that you're going to have a kind of domino effect and that the Iraq war, in effect, is going to be reignited when Assad falls?
I don't think there will be a reigniting of the Iraq war. The situation in Iraq is quite tense. The Sunni groups are much more emboldened now, and they're protesting around the clock against Maliki. So Maliki is in a difficult position already. The key, of course, is what King Hussein Abdullah once said, the Shiite crescent, and the fear that Hezbollah plus the Alawites in Syria and Iraq and Iran would create that crescent. I think that is the key, and I think the fall of Syria would have a negative effect on Iran, but I'm not sure that we would have the kind of internal war that you're talking about. I think it will just have a bad effect on Iran and Hezbollah probably in Lebanon, but I'm not sure how much it would affect Iraq. It might weaken Iraq to a certain degree because the Iraqis are now supporting Assad for, I'm not sure why, but they're supporting the Assad regime. Maybe they're making money out of it. I don't know.
Well, the other domino, if you will, at least a flashpoint in this complicated situation vis-a-vis the Syrian civil war and how it's impacting the neighborhood. Syrian rebels have seized a 15-mile buffer zone between the Jordanian border to the Golan Heights. So now you have the Syrian rebels face-to-face with the Israelis. And these are fighters from the al-Nusra Front, which are often referred to in the Western press as being al-Qaeda-affiliated. Do you think that there's, obviously that's a flashpoint, but what's your understanding about what's happening there in that border zone between the Jordanian border and the Golan Heights?
On paper what you said raise the fears, but I think the rebel groups in Syria have their hands full with the Syrian army. I don't think that they are in the same league with the Israelis. I mean, they're having a hard enough time with the Syrians. There was some shooting across the border yesterday, I think, and the Israelis kind of wiped out, you know, the source of the shooting. I don't think that these groups that are much less disciplined and trained would stand, you know, a moment in front of the Israeli arsenal. I don't think they're, I mean, they would be really suicidal, if you will, to try to break into the Golan Heights. And I think their colleagues in the secular anti-Assad movement will not allow them, because this would it would ruin the efforts to bring down the Assad regime. You know, I don't think that that's in the cards now. They're all, you know, committed to bring down Bashar al-Assad, and I don't think they will attempt to test the Israelis, and because the Israelis will be, you know, merciless.
So, Daoud Kitab, the Syrian rebels have just seized an airbase in Dara, which is right across the border from you in Jordan. It's also where the Syrian rebellion began. Is that significant?
Again, it's significant in what I was telling you earlier, that the biggest enemy to the rebels is the planes that are bringing down, you know, hell from the air. I don't know if these people can use these anti-air missiles that they've taken care of, but I think the Syrian Air Force would not attempt to get close to them. And I think in that sense, it's a strong point for the rebels that they can at least protect their new discoveries, their new, you know, liberated areas, if you will.
Well, the Syrian rebel leader who just quit in disgust at the West said that, you know, that all the West is concerned about is the length of the fighters' beards and not the fact that they're so outgunned by Assad's military. What's your sense then of the day after in Syria, which seems to be the concern on the part of the West? There's been even discussions along the lines that Syria could end up as a Somalia on the Mediterranean.
I've been checking a lot on this. I think it's exaggerated, the numbers and the power of the Salafite or the jihadist elements that are in among the rebels. The majority of the Syrian Free Army are secular, are not religious. I don't think that this is a game changer in any way. I don't really think that this idea of a Somali, you know, Somalization of Syria is really not born in on the ground. But, the Americans are quite tested because of what happened in Afghanistan. They supported the Mujahideen, and the Mujahideen turned against them. So I think from that perspective, I can understand their hesitation. But on the other hand, they're allowing the Assad regime to slaughter these people. And I think, in a way, it seems kind of hypocritical to basically be about freedom and independence and human rights and then stand by when these people are being killed. And I think there's certainly enough disciplined rebels, if you will, that they can support without having to worry about the weapons getting into the hands of the, extremists, if you will.
Well, just in closing, Daoud Kitab, I take it that you feel that Iran is going to be the loser in this situation and, by extension, Hezbollah. What's your picture, then, of the day after?
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, this day after is kind of dragged on for now a while, so it's not as easy as I think one might think. It's a prolonged conflict, and as long as the Russians and the Iranians are backing Assad regime, and as long as the rebels are not trained and aren't equipped, it might drag for some time. But what happens after the day after, I think it will take some time before things settle. And I think, by and large, the key to everything is that people should have the freedom to decide their futures. As long as that principle is upheld, I think it will be okay.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us from Amman today.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Dawood Khattab, again, former Ferris Professor of Journalism at Princeton University, where he taught a seminar on new media in the Arab world. Khattab is a Palestinian journalist and media activist who was born in Jerusalem and studied in the United States and lives in Jordan. In 2000, he established the Arab world's first internet radio station, Aman Net, and he is an award-winning journalist and TV producer active in media freedom efforts in the Middle East. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with renowned media theorist Douglas Rushkoff. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Douglas Rushkoff, a world-renowned media theorist whose 12 books, including Life, Inc. and Program or Be Programmed, have won prestigious awards and have been translated into 30 languages. He is a commentator on CNN and a contributor to The Guardian, Discover, and has also made the PBS documentaries The Merchants of Cool, The Persuaders, and Digital Nation. He advocates for digital literacy at codeacademy.com and teaches at New York University and the New School. His latest book, just out, is Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. Welcome to Background Briefing, Douglas Rushkoff.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
And Douglas, just to sort of deal with my puzzlement about this paradox, because I recently interviewed a specialist on the student loan crisis. And, you know, it's just that the student loan debt has just passed $8 trillion, making student debt second only to household mortgage debt. And this is a new phenomenon. In fact, you know, the millennial generation who have all of this electronic facility with iPhones and Twitter, et cetera, they're also being indentured in a way that's never happened before to the company store, if you will. And I don't understand this paradox where you have such you've got the most digitally sophisticated young consumers on the planet, but there are no jobs for them.
Yeah,
and they're laden up with debt. I mean, I'm sorry.
It's the perfect perfect equation, at least as far as corporate capitalism goes. I mean, you know, there's a lot of ways that I look at this phenomenon, I guess, as a symptom of present shock. On the one hand, you have an economy, really, a money system that's based on time, right? The kind of money we use, which was invented back in, you know, 1200, is basically money with a clock in it. It's created. It's literally put into the system as debt. You know, so there's interest that has to be paid back in time and in a greater quantity than you borrowed it. So everything about our economy requires growth. It grows at the rate of debt. And when we don't have new colonies to take over, when we don't have new industries to expand, you know, we start looking for other ways to grow money, or investors do anyway. And in this case, it's, you know, rather than on the backs of homeowners, it's on the backs of students. You know, the irony is, of course, that students now, or people who want to be students, have a whole bunch of other means at their disposal to get an education, even for free. You know, they'll go to Coursera and Udacity and Codecademy, for that matter, and get their own, you know, do their own sort of a la carte education. You know, but then, of course, the problem with that is when you have infinite choice as a student and can do everything exactly configured the way you want, you kind of tend to lose out on the wisdom of your discipline. You know, you sort of miss out
on anything to do with surrendering your authority to some kind of a school or teacher.
Well, but you have to, the government, I mean, what you're doing and others are doing in terms of providing alternative education, our tax dollars are going to these rip-off for-profit colleges that pop up all the time. They spend most of their money on promotion and marketing, and they just recycle borrowed federal money that they get at real low interest rates, and then they charge it back at high interest rates, indenture these kids and give them a worthless education. So there's a disconnect between what our government is doing and what you're talking about.
Right. I mean, well, luckily there's people who are putting up free. I mean, you could pretty much get as good or better free education online as you can paying for it. And I would even think in most cases when you're paying for it, what you're getting is worse than what you're getting for free. Of course, what you're paying for is this degree, is some, you know, accreditation from an institution, which is really the only thing that they have left to offer. You know, but I think the hollowness of these authorities or of these kind of central institutions to dub authority onto an individual is growing ever more clear to people. It's like, well, I can pay $20,000 and get this stamp of approval from, you know, University of Phoenix or something, or I can just learn all this stuff for free and go right to work. You know, that's part of what I'm looking at as a symptom of presentism, as a positive one, where people are doing things for their own sake. I'm taking this course in order to learn something rather than to get something else in the future.
Again, I'm speaking with Douglas Rushkoff, a world-renowned media theorist whose 12 books include Life, Inc. and Program or Be Programmed. He's won prestigious awards and has been translated into 30 languages, and he's a commentator on CNN and contributor to The Guardian, Discover, and also has made the PBS documentaries The Merchants of Cool, The Persuaders, and Digital Nation, and he advocates for digital literacy at codeacademy.com and teaches at the New York University and the New School, and his latest book just out is Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. And, of course, Present Shock, of course, is an obvious riff on Alvin Toffler's Future Shock. But just explain the central thesis, though, of how we're essentially technology is not the problem, but our misunderstanding of time, where the priorities of the moment seem to be everything.
Right. I mean, what I was looking at originally was just the notion that, you know, as we lived in the 90s, you know, and saw everybody kind of leaning into the future, becoming a futurist of one kind or another, it felt like the 1990s was very much about what is the next big thing, you know, and the internet came along, and as I saw it, was this terrific boon, really, for something else. I felt like here we are. We've got this tool. Now we can begin to connect, and we can start making things. We can replace these interest-bearing currencies with peer-to-peer currencies instead of working through corporations. We can begin to transact and exchange value directly. But the internet phenomenon got sort of rebranded as this revolution, as this, you know, new kind of kick of steroids for the NASDAQ stock exchange, and really just an amplification of the same old industrial age values that were driving us off a cliff to begin with. You know, and as a result, I feel like the digital culture we got is much more a series of distracting pings and calls to marketing, and there's this sense of just continually needing to keep up with everything that's happening rather than realizing that all of these tweets and Facebook updates and banner ads and even big data equations are all just trying to keep up with us. You know, that yet again we're being distracted from, you know, our true power as individuals and communities, which is by inhabiting the real world present moment.
But isn't there a problem, Douglas Rushkoff, in terms of a consensus on what is real in the real world? You mentioned in your new book, Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now, about the proliferation of conspiracy theories on the web, and that you talk about narrative collapse. And, of course, you have this phenomenon where on the right you have the birth of conspiracy theories, and on the left you have the 9/11 truth conspiracy theories. And there's no consensus anymore, or at least a diminishing consensus anymore about what is true. People do their own reality shopping. Christians get their information from Christian TV, right-wingers from Fox, liberals from MSNBC, and so on. So I see that as an extraordinary danger as a society when there's no consensus anymore about what is real.
Right. Well, there's a great challenge. I mean, as we emerge from a culture of stories, you know, which we believed, you know, these ends justify the means, eyes on the prize stories, whether it was, you know, Christianity or capitalism or communism or fascism or whatever, you know, to gather around a charismatic leader and follow them, you know, through hell into some future victory. You know, now that those stories have fallen away, you know, we've kind of realized in the 20th century that none of them are quite true and that the ends don't tend to justify the means. You know, we're looking to make sense in other ways. And the danger, of course, is when you're trying to make sense completely in the present tense, is you just draw connections between things. You know, this must be connected to that, must be connected to that. You look for patterns where there are none just to try to see some order. I feel like that's more of a beginner's response. You know, and the more relaxed, the more comfortable we can get actually, you know, living in the present, the more we can begin to look to each other, you know, sort of off our screens and into each other's eyes, you know, off the news and into our own community. You know, and once you start connecting in a real way with, you know, with the people who are trying to grow food in your town and looking at how energy is produced and looking at how your economy actually works, then all of a sudden a lot of the things that you've accepted at face value, even, you know, jobs, which I've always had a problem with this notion of jobs being on the front burner of everything, who really wants a job? I mean, I think people want stuff, people want work, people want meaning, but jobs are actually a rather recent phenomenon, only, you know, since the invention of the corporation. We used to not work that way. You know, that as people kind of engage more fully in the moment they're actually in, and less in all of these symbol systems, less in all of these media, and certainly less in the you know, the kind of the strange silos that we find ourselves in when we go online and end up increasingly, you know, finding ourselves marketed back to ourselves. You know, the more chance we end up with getting, what I think is a more if anything, a fact-based bearing on our reality.
So do you think, that Douglas Rushkoff, that we can, as a society, you know, and particularly with the younger generation being indentured by the corporate state, can we move further towards a kind of more communitarian-based society that you're talking about, where materialism is not the main form of transaction, that there are other ways to barter, that we get off corporate food, that it's not just destroying our bodies with the obesity epidemic, but it's also destroying our agriculture and our land and our water. So there's any number of reasons that we should change our lifestyles to save the planet, in effect.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely believe we have more than the ability to meet our needs and one another's needs, you know, directly. You know, I feel like we can farm and we can create alternative sources of energy. We can educate each other. You know, I think we have more than enough resources to go around. The real question will be how vociferously will kind of the established institutions enforce the debt that's already been created. In other words, if young people decide, you know, I can't pay this back. I won't pay this back. I don't care if I ever have a credit rating because I don't need a mortgage because I have a community where I can live and where we can support each other. The question is, as more and more people do that, will they reinstate things like debtor's prison? You know, will they really become, you know, intolerant of people just throwing their arms up and saying, I can't, not only I can't do this, but I won't do this. You know, you can't squeeze blood from a stone. I'm not even going to try to earn the kind of money I would need to pay you back. Goodbye.
So just back to your book, Douglas Rushkoff, Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. Could you explain this notion that there's a dissonance between our digital selves and our analog bodies that has thrown us into a new state of anxiety, which you call present shock?
Yeah, I mean, in the particular kind of subcategory of present shock you're referring to is what I call digiphrenia. And the idea is that, you know, we thought, or people told us anyway, that the problem with the information age was going to be, you know, data overload, you know, too much information coming at you from everywhere, and you won't be able to have enough filters to process it. And what I'm finding instead, the real problem most people have, is that, you know, digital technology is really good for making copies of things, but people are not copied so well. So we end up with, you know, three or four or five different sort of incarnations or instances of ourselves online operating simultaneously, whether that's your Twitter profile or your Facebook thing. You know, Zuckerberg and others at Facebook are, you know, right now using our images to advertise products to friends and friends of friends, even when we're logged off and not there. So when you have so many different selves sort of operating on your behalf out there, it becomes very disconcerting. It becomes very difficult to manage. And you go back online or go back to your inbox, and when you see what you, in theory, have done, it can be very disorienting. So I'm kind of arguing for people to take charge of these sort of many digital representations and even kill off the ones that they don't feel are really well within their control, so that they're not, you know, kind of so off-centered and distracted by what they may or may not be doing.
Well, it often feels to me like you could turn Winston Churchill's great World War II adage, you know, never before in the field of human endeavor has so much been said by so many about so little.
Right. Exactly. Or so little been said by so many, or something in this case.
Right.
You know, because, and the thing is that most of the stuff people are writing out there isn't even really from themselves. They're just commenting on someone else's comment on someone else's comment.
Right.
You know, and it's just business. I mean, it's just more clutter, you know, and that's why, again, you know, I find, you know, that whatever's going on, whatever's vibrating on your cell phone, you know, is not as important as what's going on, you know, right in front of you with other humans. You know, this, when you're, whether you're having a dinner, sitting on the couch, you know, the people that you're actually in real meat space with, as we call it affectionately, mm-hmm. Are valuable on a level that what's happening out in cyberspace just really never will be.
Well, Douglas Rushkoff, I thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for what you do.
Again, I've been speaking with Douglas Rushkoff, who's a world-renowned media theorist whose 12 books include Life, Inc. and Program or Be Programmed. They've won prestigious awards and have been translated into 30 languages, and he's a commentator on CNN, a contributor to The Guardian, Discover, and has also made the PBS documentaries The Merchant of Cool, The Persuaders, and Digital Nation. He advocates for digital literacy at codeacademy.com and teaches at New York University and the New School. His latest book just out is Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And again, I'll be back again on Tuesday at 5 p.m. Bye for now. Time.